Radio City once again. John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you and hanging out for, oh, the hour or so, as we always get a little long-winded with these things. And Rob Ross, how is everything going in New York?
You really want to know?
That good, huh?
I hate this city.
What's going on?
I wish a pox upon the mayor. I mean, is that something you haven't heard me say?
Right.
You know, ad infinitum for how long now? Oh, maybe since we were stupid enough to elect him in the first time. Thankfully, I didn't vote for him in the re-elections. But, you know, there have been a number of crimes that have been going on in the city on a fairly continual basis. Now, I want to preface this by saying all you hear about is him hyping how crime is down in New York. That's called bull.
Okay.
Pure and simple. Just random attacks by street people, homeless people, vagrants, bums, call them what you will. You know, this is not a moment for compassion. These are thugs roaming the streets. Last week, a fellow from New Jersey and his wife were just walking around the Madison Square Garden area and were randomly attacked by this guy who punched the wife and then punched the guy pretty hard. He was arrested. Turns out the guy has 12 priors already.
Oh, imagine that. Yeah, right.
And he's already been released. Now,
he's been released again since then?
Yes.
Well, he's obviously learned his lesson.
Of course, because, you know, in de Blasio's idea of New York, it's all about fairness, which means the police are not allowed to do anything.
You know, some people are in prison fairly.
Is that so?
I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say, so, you know, if you look at enough prisons, you're going to find a dude who did what put him there and deserved what he got.
So then, hypothetically speaking, if because I could use some extra money, I go and stick up a local bodega, I'd be imprisoned fairly.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Or for the sake of fairness, they'd let me go because I needed the money.
Oh, man. That goes back to my dad. Where is it written that life is fair?
Right. Well, the thing is, what de Blasio is doing is he's pitting, and I don't care what anyone says, he's genuinely pitting the races against each other. He's playing the race card at every turn because every one of these perpetrators has been black, but they've all got long rap sheets. They're career criminals.
Yeah.
Most of them are drug addicts and vagrants, and again, they're repeat offenders. But he's doing this under the auspices of police fairness, which doesn't allow for the police to take their nightstick and beat down somebody that they see, you know, attacking a person on the street at random. They did a kind of a man on the street thing right after this attack in that area. And I found it fascinating, interesting, and very heartening by the fact that they interviewed this one black gentleman who said, I am in this area constantly and I never see police around here. And when they are around, they're far enough away that they can't really do anything. He goes, I keep hearing about crime going down, crime going down, crime going down. He goes, where? When this happens? He goes, I don't feel safe walking here, and I don't want to. I have no choice because I work in this area.
Right.
What is the mayor doing? What is he talking about? This is insanity. And that's exactly what this is. This city has become a lunatic asylum. I mean, this is all under de Blasio, and everything is on him. The latest of his machinations is in New York City public high schools. There are three in particular that are I guess, the creme de la creme, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
It's Stuyvesant High School, Bronx High School of Science, Brooklyn Tech. For decades, and I do mean decades, you've had to take specific tests. Certain students of a higher ilk take the tests to get into the schools. I took the tests. I got in. I didn't go to Stuyvesant, inevitably, but I got in.
You had the grades to do it, right?
Right. And the score on the test.
The test score, yeah.
Right. And the thing is with de Blasio, he now wants to do away with the testing so that way he makes it fairer for other students to get in. Students who aren't smart enough or capable enough. Again, he's doing it on the premise of race. I'm sorry. I went to a very white junior high school, and a very, very tiny percentage of those who took the test got in.
Got in, right, and that's the point.
Based on the merit of taking the test to see if you have the capabilities of making it in these schools because they are a higher nature.
Well, right, and that's not the only reason why you do something like that. The other reason, obviously, why you do something like that, why you give them the test before they get in, is so that you don't have to kick them out later when they start failing. And when I say them, I mean me. I mean, look, I would love to go get an advanced degree in paleontology or astrophysics or something like that at MIT. But if I walked in the door right now at MIT, I would fail because I don't have the background. I don't know the underlying shit to what I want to go there and do. So what does that make me? You know, I should get in without a test just because I want to? You know, I'm sure getting in would do wonders for my self-esteem. Of course, getting kicked out would fuck it up again, but, you know, it's all a wash.
But the thing is, he's playing it on the race card.
Right.
And I find that to be so reprehensible. And he does this because he's – and I don't know who he's sucking up to because – he's obviously in for the next, you know, 3 years.
Right.
You know, it's not like he's running – he's going to run for a third term because he can't. But the thing is, what he's doing is he's causing greater rifts than he even fathoms. Or maybe he does. I mean, he's such a loathsome and sneaky character that it – my hatred for him, I think, actually supersedes my contempt for – that guy who's in the White House right now.
And that's really going some. And
that's because, of course, as I've said so many times before, that asshole was always a blight on New York.
You knew.
Right. And he's not here in the city right now. He's over there.
Right.
You know, he's the country's problem now. He's not just New York's.
Well, yeah.
Is New York's problem.
It is for now, and it may be for a long time to come, because as you said, you know, what's he doing? Well, chances are he's running for Senate is what he's doing. So,
I got to throw one more in because I just remembered this one as well. There was a recent reconfiguration of the New York City Tax Board.
Uh-huh.
There was nobody on the tax board from Staten Island to represent us. And that's de Blasio's doing because of his dislike for Staten Island.
Yeah, because there's a
contempt for us.
Because there's a lot of cops in Staten Island. So,
and Republicans.
Yeah, and so do the math. Ugh, unbelievable. So right. While all of that's going on, well, see, there is some good news, though. And, you know, forgetting all of the stuff that's going on in the city right now because de Blasio's just screwing it up entirely, there are some good things going on and some great things. We previewed this on our last get-together, and it is now out and available. Co-op Communique, Volume 4 from Pop Dose's own D.W. Dunphy. So what do we find inside? Lots of music.
Yeah, the punchline.
Yeah, you.
Yeah, me. The original lineup of the punchline, myself, Chris, Carl, and Mark, the four-piece. This was our first – actually, this recording of the bongos, the Bulrushes, was the first thing that we played together after three-plus years separated. Was just supposed to be for the sake of a rehearsal exercise, but we decided to roll tape. And I don't remember which one of us said, hey, let's just roll it just to, you know, to have something to refer back to. And it turned out perfect because we remembered it. And then we just overdubbed from there. And it turned out to be one of the best things we ever did. I'm incredibly proud of this. It should have been the B-side of what would have been the second single, Well of Loneliness, which was actually on Co-op Communique Volume 2. The only regret I have is that we never got to go back in and mix it, you know, where it could have really exploded. But you can hear the vibe, and it's so good and it's so tight. And a little side anecdote, I played it for Frank Giannini, the drummer of the bongos, and I kid you not, his response was, I don't remember us doing that version of it. And I said, no, Frank, that's not you. That's us, the punchline. He goes, no, it's not. That's Richard singing. Goes, no, it's not. Well, if it's not Richard, who is it? It's me. That can't be. He's like, yeah, it's me. Well, who's singing my part? Who's singing the harmonies? Oh, that's me.
Yes, we invented this thing called overdubbing.
But it made me feel so good of the fact that he loved it, and
that is cool.
You know, he was like, "Oh man, this is really good. This sounds like us." I was like, "Well, you think?"
Yeah,
but we weren't trying to reinvent the wheel or deconstruct a song that was perfect. We just wanted to give it our little nod, our little salute. You know,
yeah,
that's really good. And the thing is, this, once again, as I've said so many times, and I will continue to say, as time progresses and DW continues to do this series, it's a labor of love on his part, where he wants to bring to, you know, a general broad audience artists you may not have a chance to hear, you know, and that's so vital and so important in a time and place when, even with something as wide as the interwebs, there are powers that be that control music getting out to you. You know, all these things like Bandcamp or SoundCloud, they have their agendas. But with something like the Co-op Communique, it opens a door that previously had been closed.
Well, and there's a little bit more to it than that. I mean, that idea, we've talked about this before, of the gatekeeper. The problem in my mind with Spotify and Pandora and all of the other services, even Bandcamp's own algorithm, it's an algorithm. It was programmed by somebody, you know, to come in and take a song, one song that you like, and try and build an entire playlist around it. And, you know, the problem is you still have the lack of any kind of human touch. You have, you know, what's popular with people who think this is good. And popular doesn't mean good. And that's the problem. That's why you need somebody like D.W. Dunphy to come along and say, okay, this isn't popular. This didn't sell particularly well. However, this is amazing music.
Well, that's the beauty of this series. It's like the best form of mixtape.
Right.
It's the kind of thing that we used to do when we were teenagers and we wanted to get great music around.
Or girls, you know.
Right. Well, all right, then we're going into high fidelity territory there.
But, right.
But the thing is that, you know, I cannot tell you how many times I've, you know, in my life compiled mixtapes and then mixed CDs, you know, with things that I thought meshed together well, that maybe didn't have any kind of interlocking thematic unity, but it just worked. You know, I wasn't adverse to sticking Echo and the Bunnymen with Scott Walker into the Love and Spoonful into Stereolab.
Yeah.
You know, it's whatever seems to fit the feel. And that's how I look at this series. Dunphy, the thing is, Dunphy is a musician. He has the understanding. He has the heart. He has the mind. He has the empathy with other musicians of what works. And when you look at the diversity of what's on this compilation, it's wonderful. I mean, you've got us. You have Lindsay Murray, who, of course, is trading under the name of Gretchen's Wheel, who we absolutely love.
Yeah.
Mike Indes. You know, Popdose's own Ken Shane is on there. It's 55 different artists. Dunphy himself is on there with a great track, by the way. And that's not nepotism. I wouldn't say it if I didn't think so. You know, and that's the beauty of going through this. You sit there and you go, okay, this is really good. Who's this? All right, let me look into it a little further. What else have they put out? That's the whole point of it.
Right.
I'm on it and I'm doing it.
Yeah,
well, that's the whole reason for the exercise.
That's how we all found our favorite albums, you know? And we, you know, if you heard one track or you had a friend come up and say, "I heard this amazing song, you got to check this out." What was the next thing you did? You went and found out what else those guys put together.
Right. I mean, look, going back to the summer of 1982, accidentally reading about before hearing it, and then realizing when I heard it for the first time, oh, this is that band I read about, REM.
Right.
And then you go out, you buy that. The great thing is you go out, you make the investment in a 5-song EP, and then you start to preach the gospel.
Yep.
And it goes one of two ways. People either go, ew, what the hell is that guy singing? Or, wow, that's really good. And then the first album comes out, and word of mouth starts to spread like wildfire.
Right. And as you said, 55 tracks, 55 artists. So you're going to find something you absolutely love in all of this. So go check it out. Co-op Communique Volume 4. And again, for people that may have missed us last time around, how do we find it? Where is it?
It is on Bandcamp. And it is under Co-op Communique, Bandcamp.com/album/ The co-op communique, that's the dash co dash op dash communique, that's Q-U-E on communique, dash volume dash four. But you can easily find it just looking it up, or you're welcome to come to my Facebook page. The link is up there. Click on it. It will take you right to it. It's wonderful. You'll be able to find the entire series on Bandcamp. Go back and look at and listen to all of them. I cannot recommend it enough.
There you go. You could do worse than that, and we've got a whole bunch more to talk about on tonight's little broadcast as well, because there is we had talked about a month ago about the death of Toys R Us, which is still kind of happening. And I mean, there a lot of the stores are still open, but they're in their final stages. And there was talk that maybe somebody would come in and try to revive it, and that fell through. So Toys R Us is going the way of all flesh, at least for now. On the heels of that, and I mean, this has actually been going on for a lot longer with Sears and JCPenney's and the rest of them. The department stores have been dying for a very long time. And Sears now, over the course of this last week, announced that they're closing 72 more stores. I say more stores because they had already closed over 100 of them. So we're losing, I think, two or three in the St. Louis area. And I don't know how many more are still around in New York, but still, the department stores obviously are having something go dramatically and drastically and probably irretrievably wrong. And, if they didn't see the writing on the wall 25 years ago, I just don't know what to say to them at this point.
So far, and I'm saying so far, I haven't heard whether or not the one that's here in Staten Island is closing.
Okay.
Now, they downsized it enormously, and I do mean enormously. It used to be two floors in the Staten Island Mall. It's now down to one.
Mm-hmm.
As of right now, I think it might still be open. I haven't seen it on the death list, as it were.
Right.
But just the mere fact that it's less than half the size that it was. You know, the fact is, Sears had to sell off their two biggest assets, Kenmore and Craftsman.
Right.
They don't really have anything to trade off of anymore. Sears is almost now the company that it took over, Kmart.
Yeah, they're very much in that same mold right now. But the problem, I guess, looking over the long haul is, okay, if Sears dies, and there's every possibility that it might, what else does it take with it? Because the malls also have been barely hanging on for a very long time. So if Sears finally goes the way of all flesh, how far behind it can JCPenney's be? And if JCPenney's and Sears are both gone and Macy's is still in trouble, then what's to anchor the malls? Are they finally going to just disappear? We've already seen a couple of them go away here in town. One of them is now, they're trying to do the redevelopment shtick with it, and they just knocked the whole damn building down. So now there's just this big, empty, ugly plot of land. The other one is one of these ghost malls that's got a whole bunch of trees and shit growing in it now because nobody's doing anything to it.
Yeah, the thing is, we've only got the one mall here on Staten Island. Ironically, they just expanded it. I mean, go figure.
Of course.
I don't know what of merit they're bringing in. With what they did with Sears and the reconfiguration is they turned it into Sears on the ground floor and Primark on the upper floor.
Right.
Which, okay, what is that? Cheaper clothing, I think. Not great quality clothing. It's kind of like that, the company Uniqlo or H&M. Paper shirts, basically, that fall apart after wearing it for one season They're cheap and easily replaceable, but they're mainly for young people.
Right.
Well, what happens when that generation's gone from buying those type of clothes and the younger generation aren't interested in garbage, frankly? I walked through the mall and I found nothing even remotely worth going into. It's that simple. We have no music stores whatsoever in our mall.
Right, nor do we.
Macy's is the only attraction there. Oh, we've got a Red Robin. Ooh. Look, we lost a McDonald's that was an anchor of the mall since it opened.
Yeah.
I mean, if McDonald's goes, a mall is in trouble.
Right. Well, and now, Chick-fil-A has gone to the different model of actually having stores of their own and not depending on being in the mall. So that's not there as a draw necessarily anymore. And The only one that I could never explain, even going back to the 80s, the height of mall culture when everything revolved around the mall, is there was never, I never saw a single customer, not one single customer, ever walk into the Baldwin Organ Store. And that place stayed open through the entire length of the you know, the duration that mall was open. How in God's name did they stay alive?
I don't know, but, you know, we had one.
Yeah, and everybody did.
It was Sears, Baldwin Organs, Walden Books.
Right. And Walden Books was always packed. But, yeah. Man, there was always one dude in a bad suit who was like 23 working at the Baldwin Organ Store, and he would stare at everybody as they walked by, just hoping that they would walk in the door so he could finally get a commission.
We had three bookstores in the mall. The way I can remember, we had Walden Books, we had B. Dalton, and we had Paperback Booksmith.
Yeah.
And we had two music stores. We had Musicland and Record Town.
I was going to say we had Musicland and Record Bar, so same.
And then Musicland, of course, became Sam Goody proper.
Right.
Then we had the store that I actually worked at. What do you call it? Music Factory?
Okay.
Music Factory was there before Record Town. Record Town was up on the second floor. Music Factory was right across from Walden Books in the Gap. And by the way, the Gap is gone. The regular Gap.
There you go.
Staten Island Mall. We have a baby Gap there and Gap Body, but the regular Gap has disappeared.
What happened? Fall into the Gap.
It fell into a void is what it did.
Yeah, right. Well, and so if the malls go, if Sears does go and Penny's follows and then the malls are gone, you know, it's odd because I think the easy knee-jerk reaction is to go, oh, yeah, well, Sears can't compete in the era of Amazon and you know, buying everything on the internet. But the fact is they were dying before there was an internet. I mean, before it was in wide use. Back in the mid-90s, they were not in good shape. You know, and that's when all of us were still on Prodigy.
The mid-90s is when they purchased Land's End as a brand.
Right.
And for a while, that kind of helped sustain them. But again, you know, until maybe 2008, it kept them afloat. But then they just seemed to go further and further and further into the mist.
Yep.
You know what? It's a changing world. Physical shopping is not really part of anyone's bag. Look, let's face facts. It is a lot cheaper. It is a lot easier to look online for something and buy it that way. There's no hassle of crowds. Odds are you're going to pay less. Because everything that you're paying the costs on is based around their rent. You're going to have these incredibly awful landlords who will just jack your rent from, let's say, $15,000 to $35,000 in the blink of an eye at the expiration of a lease.
Yep.
That's why businesses in New York are going out one by one by one. You know, there's a pizzeria that's well loved here on the island that closed down after 40 plus years just this past weekend. Why? Because the landlords who own the building jacked it up to $45,000 a month. I mean, come on.
Which means they wanted something else in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's the brick and mortar world as we know it is dying. It's a very long, slow, protracted death.
Yeah.
The only thing I can foresee sustaining, not great, but supermarkets and box stores like Walmart and Target.
I know eventually my kids are probably going to buy produce and stuff like that online. I can't see doing that. I can't not have it in my hands before I take it home.
Right. I mean, there have been a couple of episodes when, you know, time was not on our side, like when we come back home from vacation. So we would, you know, order from Fresh Direct or one of those companies. But that's, you know, it's the six of one prospect, but it's not something that we do on a regular basis. It was just a time saver because we were exhausted from traveling. But otherwise, every week, like you do, we're up and we go out and we make sure, you know, we're there checking, you know, the quality of the bananas, the blueberries, fresh breads. That's how you have to shop. You cannot shop without seeing the product. I'm sorry. It just doesn't work that way.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, I'm hoping at least some of this sticks around, and who knows, maybe there will be some return to it. You know, maybe culture will get bored with having everything delivered. Now, on another subject entirely, and I know you've seen this already. I have not, but I don't care about spoilers. I think people whine too much. The Americans hit its series finale, and I've heard good things so far. I was a little surprised, honestly, because I started seeing these lists come out of, you know, the best series finales ever and the worst series finales ever and all of this stuff. And most of them said that The Americans was on their best list. It wasn't number one. For that, they usually cheaped out and chintzed and went with MASH, which was terrible. But, you know, it was at least not on their worst list. So I guess they didn't do anything to piss anybody off.
Oh, they pissed me off.
Oh, did they?
You know what? They did a complete turn from the prior episode. If they would have left it there, it would have been better off as a cliffhanger. I thought it was absolutely dreadful. I thought it was the cheapest cop out. And then I read a brief interview with the writers who said, "Oh, well, we planned it this way all along from the third season onward."
Uh-huh.
Because they thought that the narrative would take too long to get to. Because people asked them, "Well, you know, you've skipped your way through the 80s. You know, why didn't you take it to the natural conclusion?" And they're like, "Oh, no, no, well, we planned it this way because, you know, where we were when we started conceiving the end of the show." Well, gee, thanks a lot. You've really screwed the audience then.
Right.
So in other words, we had to sit through three seasons of plotting, boring stories that really didn't make us feel like we cared anymore, frankly, because you got into it at the outset.
Right.
First two, three seasons were intense.
Yeah, and you can't do that. You can't spend 3 years setting up a finale that you already know is going to happen. You know, just to wrap everything up in a nice, tidy little package. I think that's lousy. That's terrible writing is what that is.
Exactly, and I thought the way they did it was so ham-handed. In the real world, Stan would not have let Philip and Elizabeth stand there and confess to him that, yes, we are indeed Russian spies and we're your neighbors, and not shoot them.
Right.
Or take them into custody. What fucking planet are you on?
Well, you know, there's bad hombres on many sides. Many sides.
A lot of bad hombres.
That happened. I don't know if there's anything else that hadn't hit its finale yet, that at least that was gonna for the first part of the year.
Well, let's see. Their finale was a cock-up. Once Upon a Time was a cock-up. I mean, it was just... Let's chalk it up for everybody did shitty series finales. You know what? You're better off getting canceled during the summer and not finding out about it. Because if you have a planned finale, it's going to suck.
Right. Yeah, like that's... Taxi. That was the thing where they brought NBC brought the Taxi cast back because they were canceled in hiatus. So they didn't know that their last episode was their last episode. So they went and did Saturday Night Live.
I don't remember it, but I remember it was canceled right before Andy Kaufman died.
Right.
That's all I remember.
Yep.
But the thing is, you know, shows that have a plan, you know, shows that have planned obsolescence, they're going to be obsolete before you get to the ending. Don't bother with it.
Right.
You know, there's just no point. I was so pissed off, and so I sat there going, "That was the ending." You know, the fact that the daughter, the neurotic daughter, who now is all of a sudden this raging Russian, you know, she decides to get off the train with them as they're escaping into Canada.
Yeah.
To stay in the United States. What the hell? And then for them to go back to Russia. Philip, who'd become so American.
Yeah, you know? Right. He's just going to reassimilate back. I mean,
right.
And that's what they set up with the Russian secretary. Or not the Russians, the American secretary that he was banging in the first couple of seasons. When she went to Russia, remember? Because she had no choice.
Yeah, it was either get used to it.
Right, and she didn't. I mean, they showed her life a couple of times, and it was miserably bad. Right.
And he says to Elizabeth, you know, "How are we going to do this?" And she'll go, "We'll get used to it."
Yeah, right. No,
they won't. I mean, you know, okay, so you're leaving the comfort of the United States for, you know, cold potatoes and borscht every day for a meal, working in a factory, unless you get shot for being a traitor and foiling the plot to kill Gorbachev.
Exactly.
I mean, that was just such a – congratulations for fucking up the ending of what had been a fairly good series. Great job, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not easy. You know, here we are cracking on them, and probably deservedly so, but it's not easy to bring something like that to a close that so many people have lived along with you, but you owe it to them. That's your job as a writer. You owe it to them to come up with something good.
Right. That's the thing that I found myself over and over again, whether it's a movie or TV series, don't screw the audience.
Right.
Give them what they want. Give them what they want and need. I think you and I may have toyed with the idea a couple of years ago when they first announced the Americans would end. I think we may have done this on Overnight America. I mean, I had said that the logical endings could have been either one, obviously the fall of the USSR.
Right.
While they're here, and then they basically go, well, there's nothing to go back for, and Elizabeth realizes, you're right, there is nothing to go back for, because Phillip's already assimilated. I mean, he was driving around a Camaro.
Yeah.
You know? Their kids are American, so they stay and become full Americans. Elizabeth gets herself killed.
Yeah.
Or gets Phillip killed, or they both get killed by either Stan and the FBI for, you know, being found out, or they're killed by their own people, you know? Any one of them would have been much more preferable.
You know why they don't do that? And I first read about this a couple of years ago, and I can't remember the context, but it was about a series finale that everybody... Oh, you know what? It was probably The Sopranos, because they didn't say. They left it vague, you know, and just went out with Tony laughing, and then boom, fade to black and play the music. And it was at that point that they started really seriously talking about the fact that in series in the past where they have killed off the stars at the end, in the last episode, however they did it, it murders their value in, as you know, for residuals with reruns, because people don't watch reruns of the show where they know everybody died.
Well, it's not like the Americans is going into reruns.
Right. Which is a little weird, but still, I mean, even I guess if they had any kind of concern about DVD sales or anything like that, that they wouldn't do it, which again is horrible, because it means that even more so than we're already used to, the marketplace is dictating the writing on the shows rather than going for quality writing.
How many series do you own on DVD?
Not that many. I own a lot of the Mystery Science Theater stuff, and probably less than 10.
I own a total of 4.
Okay.
The Monkees.
Yeah.
The Munsters. Blackadder. Jersey Shore.
Okay.
That's it.
We've got Northern Exposure, KRP, Barney Miller, and... probably 4 or 5 more that I you know, wouldn't even think of, that are probably down there in the rack somewhere.
I mean,
some of Mad Men.
Yeah, the thing is with the Monkees and the Munsters, of course I go back and watch it over again. I would probably get the Flintstones if they were all together, but they're so hard to find as a unified, you know, the complete series. But otherwise, I have no desire to own a series. The whole point of watching it is to forget about it later on and catch it in reruns.
Right. Catch it in reruns and then get into something else in the meantime. I do, by the way, have all of the Super Chickens on one DVD. So very happy about that.
Oh, for Super Chicken.
Because you have to. It's the law. And still working on the George of the Jungle and Tom Slick stuff. Okay. But, you know.
I was going to say, Tom Slick, was that a series? I don't remember now. This is because this is my foggy memory. Was Tom Slick part of George of the Jungle and or Super Chicken?
Yes.
Or was it a series unto itself?
Nope, it was those three. So you got a half hour, 10 minutes apiece. Well, 8 minutes apiece with commercials. One Tom Slick, one George of the Jungle, and one Super
Tom
Chicken.
Tom Slick, Tom Slick, Let me tell you why. See, I know all this stuff.
It's a great show, you know? And between the three of them, they were all so different from each other, you know? Because you had Super Chicken, who was loosely based on Henry Cabot Lodge. That's why he was Henry Cabot Henhouse III. And, you know, it just worked, man. I mean, the puns that they would make in that show, and the bizarre little, you know, adventures that they would send him off on, it was just golden.
Of course, there were also, in the same vein, was, of course, King Leonardo and his short subjects.
Yep.
Tudor Turtle.
Right.
Which, of course, where Paul Westerberg got the notorious line for Hold My Life, drizzle, drazzle, drazzle, drong.
Time for this one to come home.
what was another one? Crusader Rabbit, I think, was aligned with them.
Yep.
somehow. I think I just named all three.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Because you had on the Here Comes Leonardo Lion, King of Bongo Congo, the hero Lion of Iron. With Odio Coloni, who's loyal and true blue. I think you had some of the things that went on to like the Tennessee Tuxedo Show.
And, right.
And you had like the World of Commander McBragg and all those little side bits. And of course, my favorites going further than that were Go Go Gophers. Blah, 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 blah. What did he say? Him say, whoop-de-doop-de, we have fun. Klondike Cat?
Yes.
Get me out of that now. Of course, Tennessee Tuxedo and Chumley.
Chumley, yep.
And of course, they were all squeezed onto Underdog.
Yeah, well, see, in Underdog, okay, so you had Underdog, then you had Augie Doggy and Doggy Daddy going
but
into the Hanna-Barbera camp.
Daddy were Hanna-Barbera.
Right, they were in the Hanna-Barbera camp with Top Cat. You know, so it was all, you had these weird competitions going on. So Top Cat, if I remember right, was there with Megilla Gorilla and
Dixie and Mr. Jinx.
Right. And now where did
Huckleberry Hound?
Right. And there was another turtle. There was Tudor the Turtle was with the other stuff. And there was it Touche? Yes, Touche the Turtle.
It was kind of like a swashbuckling turtle.
Right. And he had a sidekick too that was a lot like Fred from Super Chicken. So yeah, it all came full circle. They were all kind of copying off of each other.
There was also what was the name of the hippo? Remember the hippo with the pith helmet and the
yes.
Oh God. We're now all in Hanna-Barbera land, which started with Rough and Ready, the dog in the right. Those are the original. Then of course there was Pixie Dixie, Mr. Jinx, which was their first massive hit. Then you had Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, of course.
Yep.
You had the Hillbilly Bears. You had a lot of bears.
Yeah.
You had Help It's the Hare Bear Bunch, but that's the early.
Yeah, I was going to say, was the Hare Bear Bunch theirs too?
Yeah. Early Funky Phantom, of course.
Yep.
With Mickey Dolenz and Casey Kasem. Yogi Bear. Obviously, the Flintstones and the Jetsons were Hanna-Barbera.
Yep.
Ricochet Rabbit and Droop Along. That's amazing. We could do a whole show on
cartoons. I'm telling you, man. That's a lot of cartoons.
A lot of cartoons on many sides.
Most of the cartoons are good guys, though, so yeah, they got that going for them. But yeah, in the middle of that nonsense, there are some other things that unfortunately going on in the show business world that bear some talking about. And as we've been watching again, the Me Too movement start to eat its own tail, along comes this story about Morgan Freeman. And I mean, everybody, regardless whether you think he's innocent or guilty or any of that crap, when... I think Morgan Freeman may have been our first one, including Bill Cosby, by the way, that when word came out that the accusations were piling up against him, everybody universally went, oh, shit, not Morgan Freeman, really?
People who said that and then immediately did the whole, you know, they cursed him out to the nth degree and, you know, I'll never watch a movie of his again. Oh, he's vile. He's reprehensible. And now? It turns out those stories were bullshit.
Right.
And he's rightfully so. He is demanding.
I hereby demand.
A public apology.
Yeah, and he should get one too. I mean, and a lot more than that, because again, this is exactly what we were talking about. The minute that those false accusations start to come out, it gives credence to everybody who doesn't want to believe anyone, regardless whether they're telling the truth.
I'll tell you what. In his own words, somebody should... shoot these motherfuckers and rightfully take your place amongst the gods of men.
Right. Yeah. And now
you called it almost verbatim. It was bound to happen. Now it didn't happen in the way that I hoped it would happen, the way you laid it out, because it was so perfect. But here's the first. No, this didn't happen. This is bullshit. And I demand retraction.
Right.
And good for him for standing his ground and fighting it.
And the part that we didn't see coming is the fact that not only would the media, the portion of the media that, you know, that doesn't want this, any of this to be true anyway, immediately hop on board. We're starting to see some of the other accused, scumbags as they may actually be, start to use this. And Harvey Weinstein is the first one who now says he's going to go back and start parsing through the allegations to find any that he thinks are false and fight them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is going to get very, very ugly, very, very quick.
Well, in the immortal words of Pauly D of Jersey Shore, I got my popcorn. I'm going to sit back and watch the shit show.
Yeah, and having the popcorn ready, was getting ready for the other night's game, Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Finals. Game 4, I believe, is going on as we speak, by the way, as we record this. But, Game 3, back in Washington, and the Capitals took it. They take a 2-1 series lead. And so far, even though Vegas took that first game, it looks like this is going exactly the way Washington wanted it. They're dictating the pace with physicality. They're dictating the pace of the series with beating the crap out of people. And it doesn't matter that they've had a couple of theirs go down in the process, because they're so big and so tough that if they can get you intimidated early, they can score on you. And
well, that's the thing. Right now they're leading 1-0.
Are they really? Yeah, so they scored early again in Game 4.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it's going to take for Vegas to dig down and get themselves together in this game. If they do and they can pull it up, then great. Then it's just a tied series, and
right.
That's fine.
Right.
But they can't afford to let this one get away from them.
Well, yeah, and I mean, if they're able to tie this one off, not only is it a tied series again at 2 games apiece, but then they have the advantage because of the final 3 games, 2 of them will take place, if necessary, in Vegas.
Right, where hopefully the crowd impetus will help sway them back. Plus, if they can win this game, they can ride the momentum into Game 4.
Right.
So that's Game 5, sorry. So that will say a lot. Now, I know you and I really don't give a shit about basketball, but wow. You know, it was an amazing feat that LeBron James single-handedly helped the Cavaliers, or took the Cavaliers, to overtake Boston after they were down.
Yep.
How many games to none to win that series, to go back to the NBA Finals, only to be manhandled by the Golden State Warriors in that first game through no fault of his own.
Right.
You know, when you fall asleep, not him, but there was a J.R. Smith.
Right.
Falls asleep in the very last seconds of the game.
And has the winning shot. I mean, he's standing under the basket holding the ball.
I mean, Jesus, what the hell were you thinking? Wow. That might have been a greater cock-up than Chris Webber not remembering how many
timeouts. Right, back in North Carolina.
Yeah, that's still the one that I always remember as being the biggest, you know, fuck-up ever.
Right.
In a sporting event.
Yeah, not anymore. And that look on LeBron's face when he's standing there with his arms held out. I mean, it's become a meme now. It's showing up in everything. As a matter of fact, I saw a picture of that face of LeBron James, and standing there with his arms held out like that, standing in the Oval Office with Kim Kardashian and Donald Trump. Like, what the fuck is going on here?
Just... Now we can segue with my nausea as I spew chunks.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that he allowed – first of all, you know, he's just been on a tear, fucking up left, right, and center.
Oh, yeah. Well, Dinesh D'Souza really needed to be pardoned.
Right. And now – and Martha Stewart said, I would not accept his pardon.
Good. Good for her.
But he'll pardon himself. Now, here's where I'm going to interject and make a guest appearance. First of all, if you don't know who I am, I'm your dead president, Dick Nixon. And I'm going to give you a round of one Dick's eye view. I couldn't pardon me. If I could have, I would have, but I didn't. Because you can't pardon yourself, not when you're a president. That's why I had Jerry Ford pardon me. So Donald Trump can't pardon himself, except to pardon himself right out of office.
Yeah, which I'm fine with.
You know, and starting trade wars with everybody under the sun.
Canada.
I mean, fuck Canada anyway, but, you know, I blame them for everything.
But still, we needed to start a trade war with Canada? Why?
What do we get from Canada?
Tim Except, Hortons. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, but Tim Hortons is now enmeshed in the United States anyhow.
Yeah, that's
true. Bank sucks, so I don't care if they go back to Canada.
Yep.
You know, they don't have the expos.
And those protectionist bastards won't even let us watch Letterkenny. So, you know, screw them.
Yeah, see what I mean? Fuck the Canadian.
All the
terrorists in, you know, that's how they get in here, you know, by way of the north.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know, like the guy who was going to blow up the power station in Los Angeles. But you know, I'm going to keep banging the drum on Letterkenny because I'm telling you, Rob Ross, you are going to watch that show one of these days and you are going to thank me and go, oh, you were right all along. This is the funniest show I've seen in years. It's brilliant. And it's the one thing that came out of Canada since SCTV that's worth checking out.
Nothing will ever be as funny as Randy Macho Man Savage's Grandpa Ghostal on Space Ghost.
Also true.
To that. That is true. Still the greatest moment of all the... I don't know. That sounds a lot like Macho Man Savage. Ooh, is that Blip over there? You Blip?
Still, you got to watch Letterkenny. Take my word for it. You're going to love it.
Well, I mean, just the mere fact that Donald Trump had that piece of shit, Kim Kardashian, in the sacredness of the Oval Office.
Yeah.
You have no idea how angry that makes me. You've got the biggest piece of shit in the world having the other biggest piece of shit in the world. No, strike that. She's a bigger piece of shit than him because he's a fucking clown.
Yeah.
She's a twat, you know? Yeah. She's just a reprehensible twat. And if her douchebag of a husband was there, I would just pray that a bomb would drop on that fucking Oval Office.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just – I mean, when it comes to being overall useless – I can't think of anybody who embodies that more than Kim Kardashian.
It is disgusting, and it doesn't matter what your political leaning is. Everybody, I don't care if you're left or right, you should all, every one of us should be beyond pissed off that piece of shit was in the Oval Office.
Yep.
Period. Not just the piece of shit sitting behind the desk, but that piece of shit in particular. End of fucking story.
Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs.
Now, we do have to do a spin back onto the whole Roseanne thing because this week, Samantha Bee, thinking that she's so much smarter and wiser than everybody else, called Ivanka Trump, the daughter of the President of the United States, whether you hate him or not, whether you hate her or not, she called her a feckless cunt
yep.
on the air. Did you really expect that there isn't going to be blowback for saying that?
Yeah, you know what, though? I would bet that if Roseanne hadn't happened days before – that would have blown over. That would have blown over in nothing flat because Samantha Bee does stuff like that on her show all the time. And it was only after everybody, because they went out headhunting. They went out looking. As soon as the Roseanne thing blew up and she lost her agent, she lost her show, the right-wingers went out looking for a lefty. They tried it with Bill Maher and then found out, no, people on the left hate Bill Maher too. So that didn't work. And then Samantha Bee walked right into the buzzsaw. Now, was it her own stupid fault? Yep. But she did them a favor. And, you know, she's much more accepted, generally speaking, on the left than is Bill Maher. Because Bill Maher's, you know, he's got his tendencies to be, kind of racist, you know, and kind of religiously biased and all of that stuff. So there's always this hands-off kind of thing with him. But with Samantha Bee, she's very much in that same Jon Stewart mold, because that's where she came from, was The Daily Show. And so, yeah, they like her. So they found somebody the left liked, and they went right after her for something that was not that big an infraction in the first place.
But the thing is, you have to know that you're sucking around for a blast of gunfire.
Oh, yeah.
Stupid shit like this. So it's not false equivalency here. It's a case of, you knew what the hell was going to happen.
Right.
You really could not be that naive.
No. And the false equivalency comes in when they try to say, oh, well, she should lose her show just like Roseanne did. First of all, different companies, different images. And it's also, I mean, you can't. What it does, I think, to me is it solidifies the idea that if you are on the political right, you think of racism as kind of in the same vein as just saying a mean thing about somebody. And it isn't. Those are two very different things. So when you have somebody who does what Roseanne did, which was patently racist, to compare that to Well, Samantha Bee called Ivanka Trump a nasty name, so they should face equal punishment. No, bullshit. No, they shouldn't, because they're not the same thing. Right. You know, Roseanne denigrated an entire race. Samantha Bee called somebody a cunt.
Right. If I sat here on the show, even though it's an uncensored program, and I said to you, you fucking Jew, you know what you would say?
And you too.
Right. So there's... That washes that out.
Yeah, right. It's just six of one. But that's the thing. It's, you know, you can, and again, unspoken rules. You can always make fun of your own.
Right. And but and here's the but. In the case of when Roseanne decided she was going to dress up like Hitler and bake a bunch of gingerbread Jews and stick them in the oven, that wasn't making fun of. That was not funny.
Right.
That was tasteless.
Yep.
That was tasteless, and it was vindictive, you know. There are a lot of people who are, if the survivors of the Holocaust aren't here, their families live with it, you know, and they remember their family members. And seeing something like that isn't cute and it's not funny. And I think it was by way of that magazine called Hebe.
It was. Yep.
And I want to see them taken to task. See, this is why everybody's starting to hate the Jews, not just the Israeli thing. Everybody's starting to really go after Jews in the United States now, because these are the assholes that make people like you and I look bad.
Right.
These are the kind of Jews that I want to stomp out, because I've had enough. We need to clean this shit up, you know?
Yeah.
And I know of a couple of ways of doing it. It's called a bat, a car, and some gaff tape, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it just – I am so filled with a loathing and contempt. I don't think it's jadedness. It's just a loathing and contempt of what I see as the unraveling of everybody around us. What the grand question of the moment is, what the hell is happening to everyone?
Well, yeah.
What happened to everyone? Where has basic – I'm talking about absolute basic common decency gone? That now you have to go on TV to make a point – because you don't like a picture of the daughter of the president of the United States and call her a cunt. You know, if I call somebody a cunt, I'm going to hear it.
Right.
You're going to hear it.
But the thing is, you would expect to, though. And that's the thing, is you understand the way that works.
You know, it's just, it's called being a fucking adult.
Right.
You know, and if Samantha Bee thinks she's being funny and edgy at the same time, she's not. She's being reckless. You know, the whole idea of being a smart comedian is knowing how to subvert without having to go for the cheap shot.
Right.
You know, you have to know how to pull your punches, you know. Roseanne deserves to not be on TV, all things being equal, because she's not fucking funny or relevant.
Yes. Period. Which I care much more about than any of the subliminal shit.
She shouldn't have been allowed on TV after that not charming little stunt of attempting to sing the national anthem.
Right.
End of story right there. Her career should have been buried back in the 80s. And that's all there is to it. Because she sucks.
Yeah.
How about that, people? But, you know, it's just a case of decency has gone down the toilet on every fucking level. Even the fact that I'm using the word fucking now again, and I'm trying so hard to not curse in the middle of art, because I don't want us to be brought down to the level of everybody else. Just because we can do these shows uncensored is great, but it doesn't mean we have to go overboard. Like a lot of the podcasts I've listened to tend to.
Right.
That negates the whole point of that you're trying to make. You know, we're trying to have here a reasonable, somewhat learned discourse between two rational adults who are looking at the world around us going, what the fuck?
Yeah, well, and that's where I think it's really gone, is that two things now will get you noticed. And really what it all is it comes back to attention whoring. There's everybody – I mean, what the internet has taught us is be an attention whore. It's the only thing that makes any difference, because the more likes you get and the more notice you get, the more you're quote-unquote worth, which is bullshit, but that's another story. So if it's taught us to be in a bunch of attention whores, then what gets you more attention than anything? Playing the victim, being outraged, or doing something outrageous? Because nobody was talking about Roseanne the day before she did that. And what were half of the people saying on the day that she did what she did? they were acting outraged. Look at me. It's not about Roseanne anymore. Look at me and look how outraged I am. Dude, I don't care how outraged you are. I really don't.
I don't give a fuck about how outraged you are. I don't give a fuck about Roseanne. I don't give a shit how outraged you are about this, that, or the other, because I'm sure it's some cause celeb that you'll forget about next week.
Yep, exactly. Which
they all do. Now, here's something to be genuinely outraged about. Once again, going back to New York. There's this city councilman named Corey Johnson. He's a young man who I find, first of all, you know, I don't care that he's gay, but I find it really off-putting that at his very young age, he's HIV positive. How is that happening in this day and age after what everybody had gone through, his generation before him and the generation right before that,
right,
all that suffered and died for in the 80s and fought against a government that wouldn't even say the word into the late 80s and early 90s? What the fuck are you doing being HIV positive now? That's arrogance.
Yep.
But that's a subject for a very different kind of show. You know, if we wanted to take all humor and everything and put it aside for, you know, for a discourse on what's seriously wrong in certain pockets of society. But long and short is this asshole has now come up with an idea, once again doing all the stupid things that New York politicians tend to do, where you can change or have an option on birth certificates of what your child's gender assignment is.
Which goes to show,
and you've decided to have sexual reassignment surgery, you can change it. No, it doesn't go like that. And if you're a parent that's giving your kid hormone blockers because they think they're a tranny when they're 13, if your son thinks he's now a girl and you're allowing that, you're an abusive parent. That's what you are.
You know, the fact that it's a birth certificate is it makes it even worse, because what it does is it shows what we had suspected for a long time is true. These are not parents who are trying to work in the best interest of their own child. They're parents who are trying to make it all about them. If you put some X factor on your child's birth certificate, you're the one who's taking the action. It has nothing to do with that baby who has no idea about anything sexual or really anything at all yet, because it's a baby.
I swear to you. And I realized this morning after I heard that this generation now, maybe the one just before it, but this particular generation and the one that's about to start coming out of age, watch them all die off faster than anything else because they have no coping skills or survival skills.
Right.
It's all about me, 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 I want, I want, I want. And if I don't get it, I'm going to have a hissy fit.
Because they've been told, yes, you do deserve all of that. You do get everything for free. And, you know, you don't have to go out and work for anything. And you don't have to think critically because that's hard. So just go be you.
Do you.
Yeah.
Do
you. You know what? The world is going to do you, and it doesn't give a shit.
You know what's going to be great? Millennials are going to drop like flies. They're going to drop faster than McQueen and Hoffman did in Papillon, you know?
Yeah.
And the reason why I brought that up is because some asshole decided to remake it. Don't ask me why.
Oh, really? Why? Yeah. I almost ask you why anyway.
Don't. You know what it is? It's when nobody can think of original material, they have to start rummaging around at other movies that were, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
There's no need for remakes this quickly. Why is there a remake of this movie called Superfly?
I have no answer
for you. The original Superfly wasn't that good.
Yeah, right.
Now, I didn't really care for Shaft 2000 per se, but, you know, Hot Buttered Soul did do the soundtrack to this one.
Okay.
Roundtree was in this one. John Shaft himself was in this one.
Yeah.
And this one did have one of the greatest characters of all time, Peoples Hernandez, which was just one of the most hysterical. Jeffrey Wright was magnificent because he was the most likable dickhead of a thug you've ever seen. Oh, they call you Peoples because you were of the Peoples, I suppose. No, that's right, man. He's like, yo, Kentucky Fried Nigga. Go give me some Egyptian cotton. You fuck up my shirt. And he's brilliant because he's looking at Shaft and he says it to him. Like, that doesn't even blink an eye. And he does it straight. I was dying watching this. But it wasn't a great movie.
Yeah.
It ain't Shaft. You know,
right.
Don't remake shit that doesn't need to be remade. Remember something called New Coke?
Yeah, it didn't work out terribly well.
Hey, They called the New Monkees.
Also didn't work out terribly well. Yeah, and I can't, you know, I've seen a number of movies that have been made since my birth now come up for that, you know, and be remade. And I can't think of a single one of them that I thought, you know what? They did it. They did it. They outdid the charm of the first one. None of them.
Doesn't exist. That's no. The whole point of the charm that has sustained throughout a memory.
Right.
You know? That's the whole point. Breaking news. Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chairman, tried to tamper with witnesses in the case against him, according to prosecutors.
Oh, he is so screwed.
I get the rope. You set up the gallows. Let's have a party.
Oh, that is fantastic. Good. Okay. I hope they boil his ass. Now, that said, there are a couple of other things to get to before we get to In Our Heads. And I have to confess, I don't even know what this is about, but I know there have been several rap battles going on lately in the hip hop world. Everybody's fighting with each other again. It's like Tupac and Biggie are at it again. But in the middle of all of this,
they're not going to shoot each other because, you know, it's all about understanding and, you know, sensitivity and acceptance.
Well, bullshit. Especially when you bring a Canadian into the mix. What did Drake do?
Canadian Jew.
What did he do?
Drake, you mean Aubrey Graham?
Yeah, him.
Aubrey
yeah, right.
Graham from Toronto. Aubrey Graham from Degrassi, The Next Generation. That's who that is, people. If you don't remember, put on fucking Nick at Night and you'll see Drake. He's named after a fucking snack cake.
Don't forget who the first real successful Toronto rapper was, because I mean, without 12 inches of snow, what would this world be like?
All I have to say is Ice Ice Baby. That's the only thing I have right now. But having said that, Aubrey Graham, a.k.a. Drake, who was bar mitzvahed,
yep.
And he knows his hatikva real well, and he works it. He put on blackface. People, he's black.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's Jew, but he's black. Who gives a shit? What the fuck?
Is this really turning into a thing? Are people upset with Drake?
Yes, they are. They're very upset with Drake.
Remember what I said about outrage and the attention whore thing?
Well, like I said, he's got the trifecta of misery. He's a what do you call it? A triple oppressed minority.
Uh-huh.
You know? Because he's a Jew and he's black, you know. Well, but what the fuck? It doesn't really matter.
He's black and he's Canadian. Yeah, right.
He's black, he's Canadian, he's a Jew. And, you know.
Oh.
Bottom line is, you know what? The shit happens.
And my favorite story of this week, and you made mention of this when we were going back and forth on what are we going to talk about this time around, was this Baptist church in South Carolina, I want to say, that took out their own Jesus statue because he was too Catholic. Now, allow me to pump the brakes on this one for just a second, because I went to Catholic school and I lived in Tennessee around nothing but Southern Baptists. So I know they're not real fond of each other, but I don't know exactly what it takes to make your Jesus too Catholic. I mean, I had a good look at the Jesus statue that they took out, and I don't know what it is they're talking about. But of course, there is one other thing to remember about that Jesus guy.
He was a Jew.
That's it. So he wasn't Catholic and he wasn't Baptist. So I don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Well, I'll tell you what, the Southern Baptists are definitely on a downward spiral.
About damn time.
Just absolute lunacy. And of course, just before we started recording, I read that Howard Schultz is stepping down as the CEO of Starbucks. Yeah, get out while the getting's good, Howard, because your company really sucks a big one.
Yeah.
Closing the stores for sensitivity training? That's bullshit. What a bunch of pussies. What a bunch of cow towers. Here's the concept. I own a business, right? You decide you're going to be a bum, not wash for about a week or so. You're going to come in stinking like dog shit. You're going to sit in my establishment and think you're going to use the bathroom without buying something? Fuck you. Get out of here, you bum.
Right. Driving everybody out of the building with your stench to begin with. Right.
Right. So tell me, where is that wrong? Oh, is that not sensitive? Too fucking bad. Take a bath, bum. Get out.
Yes. So
for paying customers.
There are some things that we do have the answers to here on this show.
Because rationally, we think in the right way, you know, You want to play, but there are rules for every. This is why we have rules in society.
Yeah.
So that way there is. But chaos seems to be ruling everything or trying to subvert and circumvent basic, again, basic, simple, not morality, but just basic, simple rules.
Yeah. And facts. And you know, we're losing sight of the fact that facts exist. How screwed up is that? That you can't just make up your own reality and have it mean anything. You know? We tried that once, and it ended up with a whole lot of people getting killed over nothing. So it seems like a bad idea to go back there.
Was that Vietnam? Because that's what Vietnam was.
Well, I mean, how many times? The Crusades, the Holocaust, Vietnam. I mean, how many times throughout history has it been, well, let's stop thinking about things real hard and just be who we are and go out and kill everybody who isn't.
Well, that's the problem with the Holocaust is the fact that the Jews were all busy being appeasers while they were being rounded up. Don't appease. Fucking fight and leave. Get out. Otherwise, you don't go to the concentration camp that easily. Don't give me this shit about being German first and, okay, fuck you, you know?
You're right.
Fuck you, Germans. I'm out of here.
Exactly. Yeah. Which, you know what, that actually brings us quite nicely into the In Our Heads thing, because you actually kicked this off in my head just a little while ago when you were talking about remaking the Steve McQueen movie. Every time I hear Steve McQueen's name, I know most people go right for Bullet, and that's fine. It's a great movie. It's a lot of fun. But I cannot hear Steve McQueen's name without thinking of The Great Escape. And when I think about The Great Escape, what it does is it takes me down a list of movies. Movies like Von Ryan's Express, movies like The Manchurian Candidate, the original one, not that Denzel Washington bullshit. And you know, movies like that, that had, especially with the first two, especially with Von Ryan and The Great Escape, they had these amazing soundtracks, these huge, brassy soundtracks. And I mean, Bridge on the River Kwai, incredible music, and music that, you know, still has its place in pop culture, independent of the movie that it came from. Exactly. So with all of those fantastic war movies, I think without the music that was in them, they still would have been good films, but they would have had nothing on what they have now, because when you hear that... Holy shit, this is great. Do you like that same sort of, you know, kind of soundtrack, that way of approaching those movies that we did back in the 60s?
Definitely. And that's you know, that's something that I've noticed painfully is the death of soundtracks that have meaning. Because the whole point was a soundtrack.
Yep.
The sound, the music that you heard fit the emotion and the intensity of the scene or the overall movie of, in and of itself. You know, one of the ones I'm thinking of is... even though the soundtrack album isn't really worth that much because it's a lot of the same stuff, The Ten Commandments. God starts sending the fireballs into the rock, creating the Ten Commandments itself.
Right.
Or, of course, you know, Mr. Ham Sandwich goes, "Behold his mighty power," and then all of a sudden the Red Sea parts. I mean, you know, and then the majestic orchestral arrangements. Look, without you don't have Star Wars.
Yeah, and that's the first thing. I mean, what does everybody wait for? And when you go to those movies now, whether if it's a revival or one of the new...
you wait for where it says, a long, long time ago.
And then...
But you know what was the bigger thrill was when it was 20th Century Fox, when you heard that.
Right.
that was, but not to get off on, you know, soundtracks, you know, certainly soundtracks from movies from the 60s and the 50s, they were a completely different league in and of themselves because, again, they were scored. You know,
yeah.
Go back and listen to the soundtrack of Lawrence of Arabia.
Lawrence of Arabia. What was the other one? The Magnificent Seven. All of those movies that were based on the Kurosawa films.
And of course, then you had the spaghetti westerns.
Right.
Soundtracks were better than the movies themselves.
Yeah. Good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, just incredible, you know?
You know, it
and identifiable, and that's the other thing. Even though they all came out of the same camp, you still knew one movie from the next, you know? There's no mistaking that Good, the Bad, and the Ugly soundtrack for anything.
The thing is, how many, if you go back and look at the charts of those days, look at how many soundtrack albums were massive hit. Last week, when we did In Our Heads, More, which is the theme song from a movie called Mandokani.
Yep.
That was a number one hit.
Right.
You know? Theme from A Summer Place.
Yeah.
From the Pink Panther.
Right.
You know, Moon River, which is from Breakfast at Tiffany's.
There was a guy who was in the B movie realm in the late 50s and early 60s was the John Williams of that era. His name was Albert Glasser, and Albert Glasser did, you know, movies like The Amazing Colossal Man. Was an Albert Glasser soundtrack, and everything he did was so overblown and overdramatic. So, you know, it was like, you know, John Williams makes big dramatic sweeping soundtracks, but they're for big dramatic sweeping movies, so it fits, you know. Albert Glasser didn't need a reason. He was just going to use the entire 60-piece orchestra and beat you into submission with the music. So even for that, I think the guy's fantastic.
You know, you're speaking of John Williams. Let's start with the one that we all knew first, Jaws.
Jaws, yep.
You know, from there, Star Wars. Did he also do Close Encounters?
Yes.
There you go. And those were one on the heel of the other.
Right. Busy dude.
A very busy dude. But, I mean, soundtracks, and this is where it gets very, very, not so much Mercury, but very.
And, of course, he also did the Indiana Jones stuff.
Okay. Very Unglued was when you had what they misconstrued as soundtracks by these fucking albums like Fame and Flashdance.
Yeah.
You know, and Footloose. Shit like that took away from what a soundtrack was. You know, because those are songs from the film. Those are not the actual soundtracks.
Right.
You know, the incidental music. It's like when you have, case in point, if you really want to nitpick it, and I know this probably is, but the Hard Day's Night soundtrack album in the United States on United Artists is proper because it has the songs from the movies that the Beatles performed and then the orchestral scores that were the incidental music that George Martin delivered throughout the movie. And the same applies for the American Help album. The crappy songs that are in the movie and the crappy Ken Thorne instrumentals in between. Same thing applies with the Yellow Submarine album. Although that should have been really a double album because it should have had the songs that are used in the movie as well as the incidental music that George Martin had scored.
Yeah.
Instead, they only used a handful. They only used Yellow Submarine and All You Need Is Love and the new songs that had been recorded for that movie and the incidental music. I mean, yeah, the song soundtrack or whatever the hell they called it, the 1999 album with the blue cover has all the songs that are in the movie, but it doesn't have the actual scores.
Right.
Thing is, now when you go to a movie, are there any movies you can think of that actually, the Star Wars reboots aside, have something in it that sit, you know, make you sit there and go, ah? Because I'm thinking instead of all these shitty albums that pass themselves off as being, you know, I don't count Saturday Night Fever as, you know, oh, a soundtrack. No, that's just a bunch of songs that are in the movie.
Right.
You know? And Grease. you know, all that crap. You know, the last, I want to see if I can recall what I was thinking of.
You know where a lot of it's going right now, though, is TV. There's a guy who's a passing acquaintance of mine named Tree Adams, who is a composer, and he writes soundtracks for TV shows. He does all of the music on NCIS New Orleans, I think, and a couple of other shows. You'll see his name pop up. And he is that guy. You know, he's the one who is sitting there in front of a keyboard composing actual music for these things.
I watch this show so that it fits the scene.
Right. But he's doing it for TV, not so much for the movies. So I guess they just don't want to pay. And it's cheaper to find a song like in Reservoir Dogs. It's cheaper to find a song like Little Green Bag or something like that and just pay the residuals than it is to pay a composer to come in and do that stuff.
You know, it's funny. I would actually say that in a case of someone like Tarantino, and I'm going to hate myself in the morning for saying this, but I would actually give him a pass because he knows how to fit songs to scenes.
True.
So does Scorsese does too, but Scorsese always trades on the same shit over and over again. The Rolling Stones and Cream. It's the same stuff. I mean, he just has done it to death. Tarantino always seems to fit a song that works right in that particular scene. So I can give him a pass, you know, with the notion of 99% of all soundtrack albums are garbage nowadays.
Right. Well,
this is probably the last really good one that I can think of.
Well, you know, that's, again, we'll leave it in the comments section. So if there's one that we've missed that you think should really be on the list, then leave that there. And Rob, I will count on you to do the same thing when it finally pops back into your head, whatever you're trying to remember.
I'll call you 2 a.m. screaming, I got it.
I remember now. It was anti-MAME. No.
Now, wait a second. Everything's coming up roses.
Oh, man. Well, Rob Ross, my voice is starting to go on me now again, so I'm going to bid you a fond farewell, my man, and have yourself a brilliant week. We will meet back here next time around, and I'm sure we'll have plenty more to talk about. And by then, we will probably have a new Stanley Cup champion.
Right. So stay well. Think positively. It's hard to do that in this day and age. If the floodwaters don't rise, we'll be back here next week.
You got it, brother.
Same bat channel. I'll see you later, brother.
See you then.